The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen. Volkswagen.ie.
Or Ray at RTE.ie. Now, every Friday we invite somebody in to guide us through the soundtrack to their life. And today it's the turn of comedian, broadcaster, novelist Colm O'Regan. Good afternoon, Colm.
Thank you for having me.
I'm novelist.
Novelist.
Novelist. Novelist.
I've graduated. I have a degree now in books. From the College of Books.
That's a novel part of your introduction.
Exactly. Yeah, new and novel.
New and novel, yeah. Anne Devine, ready for a close-up. The first thing, I read a good few pages of it last night. So you are writing as a woman.
That's right, yeah.
Now, explain, is that difficult and does it often happen?
Well, I'm sure I'm not the first novelist.
No, I know Donal Ryan did it in one of his, yeah.
It's hard, it's a challenge and it's fun at the same time to try and forget what you're, you know, because we all have these internal biases and you imagine this is how other people think, you know. And it's not like she was there, you know, watching loads of episodes of Top Gear and subscribing to Shoot magazine, but there are subtle little things that you realise, actually, no, that's me that would do that or that would say that. So I feel like she's an assemblage of all the little things I've overheard or the looks or the glances. I kind of describe it as listening into one side of a telephone conversation and imagining the other side. So it's about filling in gaps and taking a punt on what somebody might think, somebody who is different to you, somebody's older, different gender, in a different situation. And thankfully, based on what people have said
so far,
that's my Auntie Mary. That's
my
mam. You know,
and she lives in Kilsudgeon.
Kilsudgeon, yeah.
Yes. Which is any small town.
It's county anywhere. Yes. And the great thing about Irish place names is that they could literally have any, they could be spelled anyway or have any sound because of transliteration of the way, you know, the way the English wrote down our names long ago. Because we have places in Ireland like Tang and Tempo. Yeah. And
Gagan.
Absolutely. And we have Lyra Compawn and Neil Willa and every single combination. So Kilsudgeon in the fictional backstory is the Church of St. Udgeon.
Right.
I haven't decided if he's a Norman saint or whether he's like one of these pagan saints who was once a frog and then changed to Christian, you know, mysteriously in the 6th century.
And she's an active member of the Tidy Towns Committee.
As it comes about in the book, she's wouldn't have described herself as, in inverted commas, prominent locally at the start of the book. She would have been somebody who keeps herself to herself, is a confidant, is known well enough, but wouldn't be putting herself forward. And she gets volunteered to be on the Tidy Towns Committee by her daughter in the way that often adult children will try and direct their own parents' lives. Her daughter thinks, because Anne's youngest son is gone to college, that Anne needs something to keep her busy or she'll go mad.
Yes.
So she volunteers her in a well-meaning gesture that has hopefully a cascade of consequences.
What genre is it in? Comedy? Comic fiction. Yeah, is it?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
And
it's Anne Devine, ready for a close-up. Not all heroes wear capes, some wear a high-vis.
That's right. It's a tribute to the people of the high-vis. The original people of the high-vis, not the more recent ones.
I used to be on a local committee back
were
in
you?
The day, yes. Yeah.
And can you remember that feeling of
we one of the big discussion points at the time was a mural.
A
mural.
Yeah.
And then we spent two meetings discussing whether we should have melon and parma ham or a prawn cocktail for the starter.
Launch. I thought it was for the mural.
No,
there's another thing there. I can imagine. I can imagine exactly how committee meetings go, because there are any committee, there are people who just love attending meetings, and then there are another group of people who have somewhere else to be. And a classic meeting is the tension between those, because who hasn't been at a meeting where the issue is starters, but at some point somebody will say, and there was a van going around and we don't know who he was. Now he was supposed to be picking up scrap metal, but I don't think now that, like, so the next thing the guards were called and a squad car appears in the story, and before long again nobody has picked the parmesan or the mozzarella
melon. A prawn cocktail. Or the melon and ham. And of course, one of the committee's members, Auntie, had an anaphylactic shock as a result of shellfish.
Right,
so we had to consider that.
Of course, yes. These are the external actors that get thrown into a stable system. Yeah, I'm familiar with that. Yeah,
right. So And so it must feel good.
It does.
To be called a novelist.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a part of me, because I was writing non-fiction books, but when you write a novel, suddenly now you enter, you've left another school, you're in a new school now, right. And everybody else is a few years ahead. You know, you're trying to go from, you know, trying to go up to honours maths.
Yes.
And people are kind of looking at you going, who's your man here now? And you feel like you're there in your short trousers.
And was it and something you always aspired to, dreamt about?
I used to write the odd essay back in the day, but then I went off and did civil engineering in college and went off working in computers, the generic computers industry for a few years. And then I quit to become comedian and gradually drifted back towards it, because comedian is kind of like doing a... It's you know, the skills you learn as a comedian can transfer in other directions. So it's almost like... getting your undergraduate.
Oh, yes. It's a base skill.
Yes. To be able to talk and remember things while you're talking and listen when appropriate, in order to see, catch people, how they talk, what their cadence is, the language they use, even describe, you know, people's expressions, all that kind of stuff. So gradually drifted back, I think, perhaps to something that I was always going to do.
Okay, which is all very interesting, but it's taken us away from our job in hand, which is your soundtrack to your life.
It was a bit like a committee meeting there. Where
who wants to be here and who has somewhere else to go? Now, you were born to Patrick and Eileen in 1978.
That's right.
Where were you born?
Dripsy.
Were you actually born in
Dripsy? Oh, no, born in... I get this wrong now. I think I was born in St. Finbarr's Hospital in Cork. Right. And I think my mother drove herself in to have me, because she wanted to have my brother's confirmation. She wanted to hang on until the confirmation had been done. Right. And then she went in herself on maybe May 1st, 1978. And I was born on May 2nd.
Do I take it then that your dad wasn't at the...
Milking. He was on the farm. Right. You know, it was equal. It was different. They specialise in different areas.
Yeah. Right. So, small farm. What type of
small
farm?
Small farm. Yeah, 40 acres on the kind of a mixture of, furze bushes and grass, really. Yeah. And there's not many of those farms left now. The small farm that I suppose often is. Usually it might be swallowed up by other farms since, but we had cows and we had pigs, and it was the kind of farm where the pigs would go off wandering with the cows. And I think at one point the pigs escaped up the road. You know, like anybody who's ever grown up in a farm dreads the knock on the door where it's somebody telling you where your cows are, because you end up kind of going in this quest up the valley to find them. Like, because we had a little bit of river along one field, and the cows would often use that river to go. It was like into the heart of darkness, upriver.
Right,
into
is that
enemy
the Lee?
Terms.
No, is it a tributary?
No, it's
the
River Dripsy, which is a tributary of the River Lee.
Right, okay.
And you go up the river to find the cows.
And is that described as mid-Cork or...?
Mid-Cork,
mid-Cork.
Yeah. We are... because it's almost defined by not being West Cork. Because whenever I say I'm from Cork, everybody starts talking about how they have a house in Glandore.
Do they? Oh, yeah. Look at you, fancy. Yeah,
well, in order to... You need to see the people you want to be, you know. So when I say, no, it's mid-Cork, which is different. The West Cork has the German ex-industrialist who now sells like hemp.
All right. At a Saturday farmer's market.
At a farmer's market. He speaks fluent Irish, and he was in a film with Jeremy Irons. Like, that's the classic West Cork person, you know, who's a farmer, a fisherman, a computer programmer, has a band, and is also in a film, whereas we'd be more prosaic, but we have our own kind of divilment as well. So we're under the radar in mid-Cork.
Yeah, mid-Cork. So your first memory... Was it a sound from the farm, or what?
Well, I think it's probably the when Gay Byrne used to have the radio show, was because I was at home. So most people didn't go to play school back in the day, particularly if you had a farm to wander around, and so you'd be like, I'd be at home from 2-3 and listening to, this would be the first sound in the morning.
There you are now. This should be the theme tune to this slot, because so many people have memories of that tune. Yeah, Tico's tune.
Is that what it is?
Tico's tune, yeah.
And it starts the day. And also it's almost a kind of a echo of this pre-school time, before the day was defined by timetables and a bus arriving to collect you and more rigid form of day. So this is like almost a primeval memory of when we ran barefoot through the meadows before the man shackled us to the industrial machine, I think. Or maybe just it was just the show I heard in the morning.
And were you big radio people? That's in 1978. Yeah, I suppose.
We would have been, yeah. We had radios that had the cities in Europe, that, you know, the various locations scattered across Europe, and Athlone and Luxembourg and, Moravia or whatever. It's curious to think about that you would define position on the radio by location, but it made perfect sense. And I used to fall asleep at night listening to the news on BBC Radio 4, so seeping into my
brain. Now you work for the BBC World Service. Do you still work for them?
I still do a bit for them, yeah.
Right.
Give me a call there the odd time. And I've been in that house, the original one, so if you go to the BBC, you'll see there's a particular World Service, there's an entire floor, there might be the Africa floor, and it's BBC Hausa, BBC Great Lakes, BBC Egypt, right. Signs up above people's desks, and it's quite evocative when you remember, you know, because the World Service
come
on after Radio 4 and you wake up in the middle of the night to some, you know, drama somewhere in the world, but it was the little earphone under the pillow kind of seeping up through you. So I remember, like, 1989, I remember the first bit of the Iron Wall or the Iron Curtain coming down.
Yeah, we have a bit of that there.
Well, the Hungarians are really caught between the devil and the deep blue sea here. They don't know what to do. In legalistic terms, they're bound by a treaty with East Germany dating back to 1969, by which the Hungarians have committed themselves not to allow East Germans out into the West through their borders. On the other hand, they've now signed the UN Convention on Human Rights, which theoretically should invalidate that treaty with East Germany. They are only a third party. They're not instigating the whole thing.
That was Misha Dlenny of the BBC World Service, talking about the crisis in Hungary as East German refugees prepare to travel into Austria and Germany.
Yeah, and it was...
You were only 11.
Yeah, but I think everybody got caught up in it, you know, because at that time it was like, oh, the world's finally filling in, you know, things are getting good. I mean, we don't have that sense now, but
no.
Between, say, 1989 and... 1999, before like the Millennium Bug started getting us all weird again, but there was this sense that the world was travelling in one direction,
yeah.
And you had books like The End of History, and this, the idea that we were reaching our potential, when in fact we were so deluded, because history goes in cycles and bad things happen and good things happen, but back then, you know, particularly you start learning history in school and you go, well, there was a First World War, we beat the bad guys in that. And there was a Second World War, we beat the bad guys in that. And look at this, now we're beating the last bad guys
communism,
from the movies. And it was so simplistic.
Yeah.
And we realise now that there was far more complex stories at hand in all of that. But that time was this period of like a movie. And if you heard the start of it, and there was a succession of good things happening. But at the same time, there was probably things underlying that laid laid foundation for something else.
Were you a deep thinker as a child?
I'm trying to think about that. I definitely was earnest.
Right.
And you know the way when you're about 11 or 12, I always think when you're 11 or 12, before teenage years hit, you're at your peak. Like that's the age, 7 to 12, where you start doing ridiculous projects that children do, boys and girls, like collecting or deciding. You know, my brother decided to write a history of the world in pencil, you know, and it just kept, you know, it's the kind, like, you have so much time.
Yeah.
You're pretty much as smart as you're ever going to be, really. Like, I don't think I'm any smarter now. And you have a sense that this is before you go to secondary school and get reset back, but you're top dog in school. And so you can be quite earnest. And I remember being like obsessed with the Amazon rainforest and preaching to people about deforestation without actually, you know, saying use recyclable paper. I was just telling people to stop, you know, telling my aunt, just, you know, we should need to do something about the Amazon. And
yes.
She'd be like, oh, I suppose we do. let me see what my schedule is like. It's good to be earnest as well, I think, because when you think of how cynical you can get later on, it's nice to remember a time when you were totally, sometimes annoyingly.
Yeah, people say it as a negative. You know, he's very earnest. I think it should be seen as a positive.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think we're conditioned. I think we protect ourselves by not getting too earnest about something, protecting ourselves against disappointment. But there's nothing like believing in a thing and going for it.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. We have a montage of music from your sort of childhood, teenage years.
Yeah.
So when you're about to save the Amazonian rainforest, you're probably listening to these tunes. There you go. So, Culture Club, Karma Chameleon, Bob Dylan's Tangled Up in Blue, and When I'm 64 by the Beatles. Eclectic enough there.
Eclectic enough and not necessarily matching the time in which I grew up in. So, Karma Chameleon was the first song I remember kind of singing on the school bus, having heard it on Top of the Pops or the radio, except I used to think it was Comedian, and because I didn't know what a chameleon was. And then the Bob Dylan one was I remember that, listening to that on a tape recorder the size of the computer that holds all the world's information now, and an old, you know, playing an old TDK 90 with a one-ear earphone, and under the pillow, and listening to that, and again trying to listen to it phonetically and figure out some of the lyrics and some of the references and getting them completely wrong. And the final one was a song, When I'm 64 by the Beatles. My mother taught me that, and I used to sing it as a party piece back to her. But as I was listening to them in preparation for this, I was thinking about the time when you had no idea what the lyric really was. It was written nowhere. It wasn't written, mostly wasn't written on album covers.
Very few album covers. Oh, yes. You couldn't just Google it and get it there. Yes,
and
you had to figure it out by listening.
Yeah, yes. So now it's the rest of your life is a process of filling in the things you thought you knew. particularly like hip-hop. I remember like singing hip-hop phonetically. Like with just, no, and then realising, oh, that was pretty X-rated what I was thinking.
Yes.
And because there's a whole website now, Rap Genie, or genius.com, where it fills in all those lyrics and also tells you the meaning behind them. And it just reminds me of a time when we just were happy to not know something and move on.
Yeah.
Whereas now the knowledge that all knowledge is accessible makes you have to go and
thing,
find
yeah.
it out.
Yes.
Because you're going to find something else you don't know. So it's we used to be happier not knowing things before.
Yeah, and you've a child.
Yeah, two now. Yeah.
Two children. Yes, and there'll come a time they're not of the asking age yet, are they?
Of the
asking big questions. You know, there was a time.
Oh well, we're at with the eldest where she's aware of the finality of life already.
What age is she?
Three and a bit.
And she's death.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and we're choosing a foreign word. She's pretty good with it. The best answer is to be honest, and they just accept it and move on. Because she'll be pointing at photos of people who aren't
your dad, for example.
Exactly. Yeah. And is able to deal. You know, is able to think of them as being in the photo and gone to live in our memories and all that kind of thing. And so, it actually the more upfront you are at the start, the easier it is to build other even more difficult concepts
yes.
on top of that. But it's funny, she loaded a CD in by herself the other day. So she climbed up, shouldn't have been up that high, but climbed up, put the CD in, and I was watching her put the CD in, and it was like as if I was watching her whittle or weave. Look, I was going, oh, it'd be great to see the old skills still there. Now look at her loading the CD, not bothering her, like as if she was changing the wheel on a tractor. You're just delighted to see that knowledge that's been passed down from generation to generation hasn't been lost, and she's not swiping or shouting at WhatsApp or telling Siri, giving out to Siri.
Yeah, or Alexa, we're talking to Colm O'Regan. He's guiding us through the soundtrack to his life. We'll take a quick commercial break and we'll talk to Colm more after that.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, we got a lot of commonality because people come in, they're a certain age and they have the same memories, they brought up in the same country.
Yeah.
So Bosco, for example, and 40 Coats and Wanderley Wagon and Gayborn, they all come up again and again.
I'm so basic.
But this is a new one.
Right.
And I was a big fan of this, so we're going to play this in. We might be going back in time to when you were younger, because you skipped on to your teenage years. So tell us about this.
This is it's Foghorn Leghorn. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the Warner Brothers cartoons because they used to combine, slapstick with then highbrow stuff that was just hidden in there. And Foghorn Leghorn was one of my favourites because he was the put-upon hero who always kind of suffered, but you ended up kind of rooting for him. Like, less so, like, Wile E. Coyote was more, I thought, pathetic. Or there was no, we didn't really connect with Wile E. Coyote because he never got to say anything. And also, the Roadrunner was a bit of a, you know, just didn't like him. You know, he was a smart arse. Yeah. Whereas there was more heart in Foghorn Leghorn. And, like, there's bits in Foghorn Leghorn where he's playing with the, he's minding the egghead, the little chick. And I think, if I remember correctly, he's trying to impress Egghead's mother. Like, that's the point. He's babysitting the small chick. And he plays hide and seek with the little chick. And so he sees the little chick hiding, goes off to hide behind like something, and or no, he hides. So Foghorn Leghorn hides behind a tree. He sees the little chick going off search, doing his sums. The little chick was using maths to find out where Foghorn Leghorn was, and he'd get a shovel and dig up somewhere else. And then Foghorn Leghorn would say, "I say this boy is rightly off track here," and then the chick would find him in the other place.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just apparently it's like a quantum mechanics joke inside the cartoon.
That. Right, right. And he used to, "I say boy."
That's right. Him. Yeah.
So we have a bit of Foghorn Leghorn here.
Let's bury the hatchet, but not in anyone's head, boy. But hatchet, head. But that's a joke, boy. You missed it. Went right past you. You gotta keep, I say you gotta keep on your toes. But toes, that is. But the fast ones get right by you. Keep your ears open. But yappity, yappity, yep. I can't get a word in edgeways. Talk, talk, talk. But no wonder you're not sharp. You gotta always, I say you gotta always listen.
Shut up. Yeah, you see, you can't say that anymore, you know. But it was, it's funny when you look at old cartoons, they all look slightly matte and not as colourful because cartoons are so garish.
Yeah.
The colours are so vibrant and actually it was easier to watch before. You kind of, they weren't as strobey as they are now, and they're
an assault on your senses, that, well, your particular
they are,
eyesight.
Yeah. Cartoons these days, Ray, I don't know what the young people, all of the Warner Brothers characters, the references, the movies they used to, so in a way any parody is in itself a little archive of the thing it's parodying. So when you watch Warner Brothers cartoons, you'll see references and then look them up and it'll give you another leap back in time to early Hollywood and all that kind of stuff. It's great.
Yeah. But if you analyse, it's like analysing comedy.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm 40. I'm in analyse heaven now. And plus, I'm willing to expound upon it in detail to anyone who wants to
listen. Who were your comedy heroes then? Because you said you went into engineering and then you went into computers. And was that a niche you had to scratch?
Yeah, performing kind of, I don't know. I think I don't know what anyone else has the experience of making life-changing decisions on hungover Sundays, where I had a particularly crap night out on the Saturday night before, and I said, you know what, I've been meaning to do this now. I'm going to Google Open Mic Dublin and see what's available.
What was the lead-up to that hungover Sunday morning?
Drink. I always had, like, I used to do debating in school and that kind of thing, but I knew I was sort of funny enough. You know, some people tell a story, they'll say, this is the funniest thing ever. Now, wait till you hear this, right? Wait till you hear this, right? Yeah. Anyway, so, hang on. No, let me start at the start. And then they've killed it. Whereas I used to find when I was telling a story to people, not performing stand-up, but just telling them, I'd say, well, here's what happened. And then build it up and then hit them with the punchline. And the rhythm seemed to come naturally to me. You know, it doesn't mean that the joke's funny. It just means that the structure was
funny. You should say that, right? Because Bernadette has been on to 5 on 551. She says, enjoying Colm so much, sounds like a natural comedian, which I love. Hope to see him in a show sometime. Thanks, Bernadette.
Bernadette. Yeah, yeah.
She spotted that talent in you.
She did indeed. Yeah, yeah. She could be onto something there. Yeah, I could be one to watch. Yeah. Thanks very much, Bernadette.
And because you were saying to Neil that you do about 15 things now.
Yeah.
So you're right. You're a broadcaster. We'll talk about the documentary coming up in a moment.
Yeah.
You stand up.
I MC a storytelling night once a month in the Sugar Club called Dublin Story Slam, which I love because it's people telling true stories about themselves, and some of the stories are incredible, and they have coincidences in them or twists that could only happen in true life. You know, sometimes a coincidence in a piece of fiction can kind of seem to fall into place and is only assemblable from the plot you've been exposed to before. But in a true story, something hits you out of nowhere. And often it's underwhelmed. It's not what you were expecting because you were expecting a Hollywood twist.
Yeah.
This is even better because it's so much more.
Is there a time limit?
Yeah, between 4 and 7 minutes.
Okay, right.
And what's great is that as somebody who writes fiction, the way true stories go allows you to say, right, well, nothing is implausible, if you know what I mean, because of what I've lived what they do.
It's that old adage, fact of strange in fiction.
Exactly. And the people, what's also great is people mightn't have ever told a story before, they mightn't have stood up in front of anyone before, and the audience welcomes them in because the audience is up for the story. They're not expecting stand-up, they're not expecting theatre, they're not expecting declamatory poetry, they're not expecting a reading, they're expecting a person just like them to tell a story.
Yeah.
And then they say to themselves, I didn't think I had a story, but that reminds me of the time. Because we all have at least one, you know, and it's as I say, it's one of my favourite jobs. And so other things I do, I write a column for The Examiner, which I find is a great way of marshalling the ad hoc thoughts I might have during the week into just something. It's a deadline. I'm extremely creative coming up to a deadline, I find, and I need a boss.
Isn't everybody?
I have 15 jobs because I want 15 bosses.
Yeah, okay, right.
I may have quit a job for that I was doing for years, but one of the things I loved about it was somebody telling me what to do.
Yeah, right, okay. Colm is brilliant. He's bringing back a lot of memories. I grew up in a 40-acre small farm in Kerry, says Pat in Cork. I was reared on a small farm myself. Cows, calves, a few sheep, horse, few pigs, hens, ducks, turkeys, spuds, cabbage, carrots, onions, sprouts, etc. And the word organic wasn't even heard of, says Tom. And does Colm have a brother called Billy? I used to work with a Billy O'Regan from Dripsy.
No, I don't.
You're the youngest of four.
Youngest of four, yeah. I don't know, to the best of my knowledge, there's no brothers called Billy. But
okay.
He could be younger than me now. you kind of think you still have a claim in a place, but I'm getting on. So there might be new O'Regans in without my permission.
You're taking part in the Mountains to See Book Festival on Sunday, 31st of March, which is Mother's Day.
Mother's Day,
with Maya Dunphy.
That's right.
And the documentary I mentioned there. His Radio 1 is starting on April 24th.
I think it's actually, might be even this, is it May? Or is it March 24th? It might even be this.
Well, what is it this Sunday?
Well, it's called Six Dads anyway.
Yes.
They can, we interview six fathers about the first year of their first child.
You're probably right because this Sunday is the 24th.
Yeah.
And if it is, then April the 24th is not Sunday.
Let me do the 30 days.
It won't be.
So
we're saying then it's this Sunday and it starts and it's you with six dads.
Six dads. So we interview them and there's some great stories about being first-time father and the first year and what happens in the lead-up to it and after the birth.
So you're presenting it and sharing your stories,
exactly,
I'd imagine, as well. Listen, great to see you.
Thank you.
And thanks for Foghorn, Leghorn and everything else. Colm O'Regan, thank you. And the new book is Anne Devine, Ready for Her Close-Up, which is in good bookshops, all bookshops now. Thanks, Colm.
Thanks.